Tonight, we are again honored to have one of our own talented and esteemed artists, Annette Lawrence, is here to shed her own light. The DFW Metroplex is quite honestly a hotbed of talent in the arts, but even among the best, I have to say Annette stands out as an artist who has determined her own path, gracefully blending a successful career, her position as professor and former chair of the UNT Art Department, and her life with the renowned novelist and playwright Shea Youngblood. We are all fortunate to have them both as active members of the North Texas community. I have to share that this is Annette's second Tuesday evening presentation. She was one of my first Tuesday evening guests when I started my job at the Modern back in 1995, at which time she gave an incredibly memorable and profound presentation. It was, in fact, Annette who encouraged, in fact, insisted that I began recording these weekly lectures. She arrived a little early for her lecture or for her presentation that day and insisted that we go to Radio Shack and purchase a recorder and some tapes. That was in 1995, which then sat on the lectern for audio recordings each week from that point, 1995, until we moved into this building where we have much better equipment. And I can always count on the very talented John Knuckles to take care of all of that. So we have Annette to thank for starting that process. And when I told John Knuckles that this morning, he's like, where are those audio tapes? And I said, they're somewhere. And he was like, oh my gosh, what a project. Because, of course, we have to transfer those over to digital now. If you know Annette's work, you know that her insistence on us recording or documenting was a natural impulse. As mentioned in the announcement of tonight's program, she works with text and information, often in response to physical space and time. Her practice is grounded in autobiography, counting, recording, charting, and layering quiet notations of everyday life. Her recent work engages time and accumulation through 25 years of keeping journals. Annette's work has been widely exhibited and is held in museums and private collections, including the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Rachofsky Collection, Art Pace Center for Contemporary Art, Jack S. Blanton Museum of Art, the American Airlines Collection, and the Art Collection of the Dallas Cowboys. She received the 2015 Moss Chumley Award from the Meadows Museum and the 2009 Otis and Velma Davis Dozier Travel Award from the Dallas Museum of Art. In 1997, her work was included in that year's Whitney Biennial Exhibition at the Whitney Museum of American Art. And there is so much more, but for the sake of time, I will stop with that. Annette is an alumnus of the CORE program at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston, and the Skowhegan School. She received a BFA from the Hartford Art School and an MFA from the Maryland Institute College of Art. Originally from New York, she lives and works in Denton, Texas, where, as mentioned, she is professor of studio art in the College of Visual Arts and Design at the University of North Texas. And tonight, she is here to present The Meantime, Before Digital, After Analog. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Annette Lawrence.
Good evening. Thank you all for being here. It's a real pleasure to be back at the Modern. You know, it's like a whole different experience because the last time was in the old building, in the old space, and it was a standing room only crowd, which this probably would be a standing room only crowd in that space. So I'm glad at least the same number of people came out. I'm going to start with thanking Terry and thanking John and for inviting me again. But I want to read a little something. April 4th, 1985, Hartford, Connecticut. I just understood something wonderful. It's kind of repetitive in Brancusi, but I didn't understand this particular statement until right now. Simplicity is at bottom complexity, and one must be weaned on its essence to understand its significance. I'm looking forward to doing the drawings I have to do. April 4th, 1989, Baltimore, Maryland. I started the day with the King stories. Good job, Dottie Green. Today is the 21st anniversary of the day that MLK was shot in Memphis. I need to study him. I need to listen to what he said. April 4th, 1993, Houston, Texas. I've been considering going to Washington, D.C. on April 25th. I keep coming across things about the March on Washington for lesbian, gay, and bi equal rights and liberation. Michelle has urged me to go a couple of times. I'm sure the experience will have a significant impact on me. That much gay and lesbian energy in one place, at one time, surely will have an altering effect. Mm-hmm. Affirmation, I'm going. Mm-hmm. In the studio, I did the Hindi John 3:16 today. April 4th, 1994, Houston, Texas. Took today real easy. I cleaned up the house a little, came into the studio this afternoon and made some more headway with the track series. It's very underdeveloped at this point. As I go along, it gets clearer. Saw a film last night about the Japanese architect Kisho Kurokawa. He described a modern Japanese home that used the principles of traditional Japanese architecture as a narrative. Walking through the house was like experiencing a narrative with each space adding to the story. I appreciate that statement, particularly now. These spaces are text. Received word from Skowhegan today. I'm on a waiting list. Not the news I was hoping for, but it's better than an absolute no. I will anticipate news until the end of April. I would really like to spend the summer there, keeping attention on it. April 4th, 1997, Denton, Texas. Joanne called, it's my sister. Anna, her daughter, put her foot through the roof of a dollhouse. It was slowly deteriorating with every move. They're going to have to give it to the trash man. Someone might see it and decide to repair it. It might have some unknown life to go. I abandoned it long ago. It really didn't have space. It needed its own room. This Anna drawing, this is my grandmother, is the fifth in this group. I'm looking at it to determine how to approach the grid. It's a weave, irregular. Charles, my grandfather, will have the coordinate axis and maybe the unit circle. That symbol from African cosmology. Eternal birth, rebirth. He will be the simplest image. April 5th, 2005, Denton, Texas. Good news today. Sasha, who's a former student, was accepted at Cooper Union. He was almost in tears when he handed me the letter. He's in shock. This is huge. Party on Sunday. Unrelated. Whose panties are these? More misadventures from funny women on the road. Edited by Jennifer Leo. April 4th, 2007, Denton, Texas. Just back from New York. Good news this morning, Scotland in June. Last week, Nikki wrote to see if I was available June 2nd to 17th for a residency. Today, I got news that I'm in. April 4th, 2017. That's how I started my talk in September 12th, 1995. So I thought I would do the same thing again tonight. I'm going to begin the presentation with a piece I just recently made. I showed it in the faculty show. It was slightly different than it is tonight. But I made it immediately after the election. It's a piece called Bantu, after Aaron Douglas, for Jimmy. And I made the piece originally on slides. It was an analog piece using a slide projector with a dissolve unit between, well, two slide projectors with a dissolve unit between them. And in 2008, I transferred it into a digital image. And then 2017, I added the sound. And the sound is a quote from the film The Price of the Ticket. It was directed by Karen Thornton.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It's taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress? What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It's taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress? What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It's taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
It goes on for another 2 minutes. This is a photo of my great-aunt Willoughby Eaton Pardo. She was at the March on Washington on August 28, 1963. If you notice at the top, the date is April 64. And that's because film used to sit in cameras for months on end before they were processed. I used to be confused by that date. I was like, that's not the right date. She sent a postcard to my mom from there to tell her that she was there I'm getting feedback. Is this better? Okay. To tell her that she was there to march for my sisters and I and my cousins and all the generations after that. So I always like to show this photo once I got it in my possession, which was only a few years ago. This piece is called, this is from 1989, it's called Drawing from Insecure Borders, and I like to show this one because it is the first piece that I made on brown paper. And the brown paper was originally just covering the walls of my studio while I painted on bamboo shades, and the paint was dripping through to the brown paper. It turned out that I was much more interested in this than I was in the stuff I was painting on the bamboo shades, so I tossed the shades and I kept this. And continued to use brown paper for a while, a long time, as the only surface that I drew on. Another very early work, this one says More, Bigger, Faster. And I was commenting on art school at the time. It's kind of my whole experience was in art school then. And now I'm on the opposite side of the podium saying these exact words to my students. It's just doesn't stop. It won't go away. I do want to read a quote, though, with this one. It's a quote from Charles Gaines. It's from a catalog called The Theater of Refusal. It's an exhibition that he curated in 1990. Marginalization is a sword with two edges. It's a sword with two edges. As we use it to attack racism, we wound our villain with each downward stroke. But each time we raise the sword for another blow, we wound ourselves. It's virtually impossible to invoke the discourse of marginality without buttressing the implacable edifice of the mainstream. The black artist is engaged in a battle for her identity, and there is no possible victory. For to be marginal is to be in the battle. This was a show about the critique of black art and artists in the early 90s. These are a group of works from the early 90s also. I started out just using text as image because I figured, well, because I was finding more realistic representations of African-American life in literature than I was in visual culture. So I translated that directly into working with text. And it's been kind of an ongoing thing ever since. I want to point out that the piece second from the right is tracks that I mentioned in my journals. And I have another bit that I wrote about it at the time. On October 24th, 1993, I wrote, "I spent some time yesterday drawing the spaces I have lived in. There are many more. I just drew my parents' spaces. I didn't begin drawing the places that I've lived in on my own. There's so many. Old addresses, old phone numbers, ways of being located and found, contacted, in touch, how that can change so easily. The trail twists and turns, and there is a map for each move, the map of the USA, the map of each state, each city, each neighborhood, the diagram of each living space, the words and numbers associated with those spaces to identify and mark them as particular spaces from other spaces, and there's a body of work here. And as I was preparing for this talk, I realized that I've always been doing data visualization, but I just didn't really think about it that way, think about it like that. The piece in the center is titled Phoenix, and it's, no, that's not right. It's called John 3:16, I'm sorry. I took Phoenix out of the talk. I didn't change my notes. But it's the actual Bible verse written in nine languages that don't use the Roman alphabet. And I've been reading up on digital coding lately. Actually, this book is fantastic. I recommend it. It's called Geek Sublime by Vikram Chandra. And he talks about his connection to he's a novelist, and he also is a code programmer. But he has this bit about Panini, the grammarian, who basically created the fields of descriptive and generative linguistics. And there's an analysis of Sanskrit here that I just feel like I had to read to you. The rules are of four types. One, rules that function as definitions. Two, meta-rules, that is, rules that apply to other rules. Three, headings, rules that form the basis for other rules, and four, operational rules. Some rules are universal, while others are context sensitive. The sequence of rule application is clearly defined. Some rules can override others. Rules can call other rules recursively. The application of one rule to a linguistic form can cause the application of other rules, which may in turn trigger other rules, until no more rules are applicable. It's from Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, Code of Beauty. And when I read that, I thought, that sounds like code. You know, that sounds like what code is. This is a body of work called The Ancestors and the Womb. I went from using languages that I didn't read or write that had sound to floor plans that was kind of a text that didn't have sound. And from there, I got interested in quilt patterns as a form of text. So this 10 pieces have 10 different traditional quilt patterns. And there's text on them, a tight spiral of dates, and the silhouette of one of my grandmothers, the grandmother I mentioned, Anna. This is the portrait that I made of her. This is one of the other ways that I've dealt with recording time is through generational time. So I did about 11 portraits of ancestors, all of the elders that we have photographs of. I used to make large-scale portraits. These are 5 feet tall, 3 feet wide. Her name is Anna Cooper Lawrence. And this is her husband and my father's father, Charles Henry Lawrence. He was a mathematician. Well, not really, a math teacher. The next couple of images, I'm going to flip between them, because these really belong side by side. I just don't have a picture of them together. This piece is called Duo, and it's in around 2000, 1999, 2000, I got interested in digital sound analysis as a form of text to deal with. I was trying to think of ways to use music and represent music visually. And I thought of using scores, but then found out that all scores are copywritten and I wouldn't be able to just use them without getting permission. So I did an exchange with John Nelson, who's on the music faculty in composition, and he was showing my class digital sound analysis. I asked him to do screen captures of about four or five different programs of 3 seconds of the first 3 seconds of the tune Alabama. It's John Coltrane's tune that he wrote to commemorate the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. So that's one piece called Duo. And I made individual small pieces to commemorate each of the little girls that died in that bombing. So there's Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wellesley, Carol Roberson, and Denise McNair. The dark space in the center is a photocopy transfer of a piece of indigo fabric. And the brown paper is paper bags that are opened out. After doing digital sound analysis for a little while, I discovered my own piano notebook in my mother's piano bench, and dissected that book and created these pieces called Theory. So it's like 7 and 8 year old handwriting blown up. You can tell, if you can see, there's like 3 perspectives of the notes. And the first perspective is just a straight copy. And I photographed it. I photographed that projected on the wall from really close to the wall under it. And then printed that and projected it and did it again. So it's sort of an analog way of getting something to tilt. And eventually I thought I would rotate it all the way, kind of horizontally. But after a couple of years of working on these, I moved on. This is the third one. There's 9 parts of this series. Meanwhile, as I'm making drawings, I'm also doing string installations. And this is one from Johannesburg residency at the bag factory there. I had a wide open warehouse space to work in, and
I wanted to occupy that space, so I found some brown paper and made a circle, and then threw string over the rafters and added my shoes. And the shoes are there to sort of indicate a figure. When we had the reception for this exhibition, some of the visitors were thinking of it like a beam me up Scotty machine. And this is the kind of the beginning of things that I made, having a sort of sci-fi dimension unintentionally out of extremely low-tech material. This is in Dallas at the African American Museum there. I was invited to do an exhibition in this space, and it's a circular space that has vaulted galleries off the center of the rotunda. And instead of kind of competing with that shape, I just went with it and made this. I put the shoes in this one also for the same reason, to kind of indicate a figure, a presence. This is one where the top of that small piece of wood is about 3 feet high, and the space that you entered was about 9 feet tall. So as you walked in, you had to kind of crouch down, and on the way back out, you had to stand back up again. I'm really interested in, at the time, I was really interested in making people move in certain ways and spaces. This one's called Round 11, and it was at Project Row Houses in 1999. Row Houses is a community development project. It's a social practice, the work of Rick Lowe and many, many artists who made installations in these shotguns. This one is called Transparent Opaque. It's at the Ann Arbor Museum in Michigan, in Ann Arbor. The dimensions on the floor are about 36 feet square. I was responding again to the space. It kind of has a theatrical feeling to it, so I went with sort of spotlights. Here we are at the DMA in Dallas, the Dallas Museum of Art. It's the same circle that was at Project Row Houses, just recycled. This is called Concentrations 36. And one of the things that I was interested in here was I didn't have much to respond to architecturally. The height of the walls and the length of the walls and the grid on the floor were basically what I was responding to. There's very little space between the edge of the horizontal lines and the vertical lines in this. So you can see the whole thing, but you couldn't really get to most of the space. This is called Theory, along the same lines as those music note drawings, or around the same time. It's at the Glassell School, which doesn't exist any longer. I haven't, the building itself was demolished, and I haven't been to Houston to see the space now, but they're building a new building in the space the old Glassell School was in. It's another shot of it. So you might have noticed concentric circles are a thing over many years. This is held up. It's between a balcony and it's on this between two floors. And the brown paper strips that you see around the edge there are glued to about 21 inches of sheetrock. This is the strips that I use. I call them paper supports. This is how they look when they're being shipped from place to place. And I was really influenced by the edge of these pieces of paper in making a body of work called Free Paper, which I don't think I have any images of because I was condensing the talk. But this is a circle called paper. I can't remember. It's a paper surface circle, that's it. And it's 1 year of collecting grocery bags. It's a 10-foot in diameter circle. And I'm really interested in that, the surface and the colors, the difference in the kinds of brown paper that are there. And I'm supposed to be telling you something about this. Oh, there's a quote. So I was introduced to a poet named Vivian Ayers. She happens to be the mother of Felicia Rashad and Debbie Allen in Houston. And she wrote a book, she collaborated with John Biggers on a book called Hawk. And it's an allegory that compares the search for transcendence and freedom with space and flight. And I just wrote this down back then. Reality is neither newer nor ancient. It don't make no difference what time it was. I got interested in thinking about the time on different planets and how many Earth years it takes for the planets in our neighborhood in the universe to get around the sun. And I was visiting the McDonald Observatory a few weeks ago, and that's when this came up. And I'm just thinking about time in terms of cosmological time, geological time, you know. Anyway, if anybody wants to do a math problem, I'm 27 years old on Mars. Let's see. So this is an image from a body of work called Drawing Blood. And it has the dates of every menstrual cycle I ever had up to the time of the drawing, which is in 1994, September, and a few small marks with blood. And I was interested in sort of changing the discussion or the ideas and thoughts about how we treat the cycles of the body and the bodies that do those cycles. This is another one. There's 9 years of these drawings. I drew one a month for 9 years, from 1990 to 1999. And then in 2009, I got really interested in seeing or thinking about what that spiral of dates would look like if it wasn't tightly drawn in a small space, like how long a line it might make. And I shifted to I drew it on a line of a counting tape. And in this particular piece, it's 29 yards. And this got me going on this path of trying to build lines to draw it on, because I wasn't really happy with the counting tape. And these are photographs of strips of paper I tore in order to build lines. I kind of like them as objects also before making the line out of them. Those pieces of paper turned into this spool of paper. It wasn't really the right line to draw on. It had a lot of, like you can see the joints. I wanted something that was like a counting tape, so no joints and a matter of flexibility. I came up with this line ultimately, and it's several layers. It's like building the line, but layer by layer, maybe four layers in order to get it to where you couldn't see any of the joints. And the dates are written inside of that. It's called Long Line 2011. And it sort of references Brancusi. So in addition to drawing the line on paper that I made, I was also interested in seeing how it looked in space. So this exhibition called Gone in No Time was in Adelaide, Australia at the Australian Experimental Arts Foundation. I was paired with Jacobus Capone. He's an artist from Perth, Australia. So I started the line just drawing it on the wall. It's drawn at the height of my eyes. So it references my body in two ways. It just goes all the way around the space. It's a very spare piece and hard to photograph. But you can see it goes all the way down the line there. Turns the corner, goes over the utility doors, across the bathroom door, and back around the corner. And this time it was 49 yards. The the next two times I drew it, once was here in Dallas, well, twice in Dallas, one at a project called Modern Ruin, and another one, another time at the Fairmount Hotel. In the Fairmount Hotel, it wrapped around a normal-sized king's suite three times. It was 30 years of drawing, of dates. Jacobus, on the other side of the room, was collecting blades of grass, one by one, and then taping them with scotch tape to the wall and floor. And he just worked around my line. We were actually paired very well in terms of our sensibilities. There he is with the floor. This is at the Dallas Museum of Art. It's a community project in the Center for Creative Connections. The title of this is 2490, because that line of paper is 2,490 feet long. And it was made by hundreds of visitors who contributed to building the line. After the installation was deinstalled, this is the result, a spool of paper. I then made a box for. It just lives in my studio now. This is a stack of my journals, and this talk is really directly related to the talk from 1995 by way of the journals, because that presentation was the first time I actually read journals out loud. And I kept reading them in presentations for about 10 years, maybe, you know, 8 or 10 other dates are part of that group. But in 2007, I started thinking of the journals as sort of raw material for work. I became interested in seeing what a single day looked like over a 25-year period. So I started researching each day of the year. And at first I thought I would type them all by hand, like type all the journals. And I was talked out of that. I allowed myself to be talked out of that because I was crazy. But the journal pages look something like this. This was part of one of the ones that I read out loud. I'll read this one. 10 years ago, I plunged into African American culture with a vengeance. My formal education had not covered any of what I needed to know about artists like myself. So I read Langston Hughes, Gene Toomer, Thurman Wallace, Zora Neale Hurston, Jimmy Baldwin, Lorraine Hansberry, Audre Lorde, June Jordan, Alice Walker, Angela Davis, Asata Shakur, Toni Morrison, Octavia Butler, anthologies of black feminists, gay and lesbian coming out stories, biographies of Miles Davis, Stravinsky, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and others. I attended film festivals of black independence, learned a lot through the documentaries there, saw as much live music as possible, found out who I was through the works of these artists, learned the legacy I was a part of. I'm grounded. Because it's a systematic negation of the other person and a furious determination to deny the other person all attributes of humanity, colonialism forces the people it dominates to ask themselves the question constantly, in reality, who am I? That's Franz Fanon from The Wretched of the Earth. I know that Stravinsky is not black. I just happened to read his biography along with the other ones. What's that?
Did it help you know who you were?
Yes, it did. Yeah, it also helped. Okay, so I scanned all of these by hand with a wand scanner, and it took about 4.5 months. And while I was doing that, it was really, you know, important that I keep a chart to understand where I was so I wouldn't keep repeating myself and looking back and seeing if I scanned something or not. These are the charts. I got really interested in these charts as drawings. And I started thinking of ways I could actually make them into drawings. And this is 1 week in March for 25 years. The black spaces are where I wrote, and the blank ones are where I didn't write. I think this is the correlating week in a stack. And here's some of the ideas that I was playing with. I was thinking of the stacks related to the charts. Like flipping this kind of three-dimensional thing into a two-dimensional representation of the same thing. But then I had all these circles hanging around my studio, and I got interested in thinking about these in a circular format that's much more dynamic than a rectangular one. I didn't say that it took 4 months to scan the journals. And each day I worked, I could scan 1 week of journals. So I would make a chart, I would photograph the stack, then I would scan all the pages, and then repeat the next day. And the rectangular journals, I didn't mention, they referenced punch cards. So I automatically went from an analog thing to a digital thing to an analog thing. That referred to an early archaic digital thing. So I did one of these drawings a month for the year 2013. And I would make, my rule was I had to finish the drawing of that month in the month that I was making it. So I was chairing the department at this time, and time was really limited, so I had to have some kind of structure in order to be productive. The first exhibition of these were at Mountain View College in May of 2014. And in addition to having the actual works on paper, I hung a few of the stacks and drew a grid on the wall. And the wall grid was the days of the exhibition. That was what the grid was made of. And the deal was that the students at Mountain View would paint out each day as the show progressed, so it was erased eventually by the end of the show. There's a few views of the exhibition. And these are much better together than they are apart, one by one. And when people came to see the show, their automatic impulse was to look for their birthday or their mother's birthday. And I had a young man come over and say he found his birthday, and he asked me if I remembered what I wrote on that day. I thought, it's like, well, no. But I had my iPad with me, and I gave it to him, and I showed him what I wrote that day. And I completely forgot about the iPad for like an hour. And then he brought it back, and then I remembered, oh, I just gave my iPad to somebody that I don't even know. But he appreciated reading about his birthday in the iPad. This is the second exhibition I had of this work. I was in Fredericksburg, Texas, and it was at a gallery called Vaudeville. And I was invited to do two additional things there. This is a rock piece. It's called Rock June because it's actually the grid for June. And it's 10 by 10 foot square with the circle in it. It's made out of lava and limestone. And it's sort of, I made rock pieces way back in the early 90s. So it was the first time I made a rock piece in a long time. There's a danger of making work on the floor. People will step on it. And that happened. This is the other piece that I made for this exhibition in Fredericksburg. I had the help of a friend, Eric Goodlett, who is here tonight, to build the wooden frame. And Dorneth Doherty helped me make the prints. They're photographs of the drawings printed on clear material. And I was interested in seeing the whole year, or the whole 25 years at once, and having the ability to look through those years and making something that felt like it was moving, even though it's still. These are close-ups of looking through it. There's more to be done with this. It's just a matter of time. We're getting close to the end here. This is a DART station at UNT Dallas. I was the artist on the team, the design team for this station. And I talked them into letting me use my work on their windscreens. So there's three different tilted circle grids down the platform. And you can see this if you take the blue line all the way to the end. It's there. It's one of the few permanent things I've made outside. These are very, very new. I've decided to do a circle grid for every possible combination of the months, the days, and the years for 25 years. And it comes out to be about 136 drawings. And I've only got four, so I've got a long way to go. I just need a block of time, like 6 months, and I could do it. Anyway, these are smaller also. The other ones, the month ones, were about 42-inch squares, and these are only 11 by 17 or something like that. They're pretty quick. They take about 6 hours to draw. So this is the number 27. This is the number 25. This is the number 7. And it's a bit of a different approach. I drew the grid and then I cut out the spaces instead of filling them in dark. I just cut them out. And this is a photograph of that template with the cutout squares transferred and attached to a wooden panel. And that's the same thing, a different orientation. And that is my last slide. So let's see. We have 10 minutes for questions. Thank you. All right.
I wondered if you could talk about how your interest in coding is influencing your work. You mentioned your interest in coding, and I was wondering how that's intersecting.
Well, the way I came to be interested in coding was by doing these circle grids, and they feel like I make systems, you know. And I titled my exhibition, the first one, Leaning Towards an Algorithm, and that sort of got me on the path of coding. I haven't actually begun to study coding, but I'm reading about it. And I find that that's how I enter something. I enter it through studying, like around it, and then eventually plunging all the way into actual coding class. But I'm thinking of it, I mean, it's a combination of writing and math that attracts me to coding. And I want to use coding to activate these drawings. I could easily have someone else write the code for me, but I just want to know how to do it, you know.
I remember in 95 when you were here, you were getting interested in math and maybe even thinking about going into math instead of art.
Yeah, yeah, and I've always been on the edge.
What was it, 2 years later, you were in the Whitney Biennial?
And that weren't that idea.
Looking at your string installations, did you have a spirograph when you were a child?
I did. It's a great toy. Yeah. Does everybody know what a spirograph is? No, there's some people in this room that don't know what a spirograph is. It's a toy, yes, that has two little knobs and it's a gray screen with border, and you drew with it. You can.
Oh, that's interesting.
Whoops. Okay, I do know what a spirograph is. Yeah. That other toy. Okay, I got that wrong. Anyway.
That was the year you got the Easy Bake Oven and the spirograph. Did somebody else have? I thought I saw. Okay, there we go. Thank you for using my gift. I'd like to hear you explore a little bit more this idea that the first question was invoking that came in your talk about the relationship between coding and your work, because one of the challenges that coding brings with it is that it's essentially a binary system, on, off, 1, 0. And it has a hard time handling ambiguity, for example. And whereas I see a lot of your work allowing for and encouraging, it's, you know, you put your personal life out there, but you also don't define it in that sense. So I'm wondering if you've thought through further down what it means to take a language, and going back to you read the quote, I mean, languages have rules, and how you might take that kind of language and think about ambiguity in that context.
I'm not sure yet, because I haven't really gotten into it, but I'm really interested in doing that. I mean, the motivation is to make these grid drawings, the circle grids, interactive somehow. So that's kind of what's making me want to write code in the first place. And in the process of learning the code, I'm going to do what I do with everything with the code, like pull it all apart, you know, put it all back together again differently. You know, so I'm interested and excited about what that's going to look like. You know, did I answer your question? Kind of. Okay.
Coming, Jerry. The next question needs to be on this side of the room.
Annette, you don't seem to be reluctant to share the thoughts in your journal, but this body of work, the circle grids particularly, seem to turn this intimate recollection of your life into a form of metadata. I know that term is kind of current. But it's like we know that you're cogitating, but you've made what you thought opaque. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, when I was starting to read the journals in order to do this scanning project, I quickly got uninterested in the writing. You know, it's funny. I mean, there's little bits of it that are interesting, but at large, it is not interesting. You know, and so the amount of writing that I did, I shifted my attention to thinking about that. Like, you know, I'm more interested in the fact that I wrote than what I actually wrote. When you look at it like day to day, it is really like you want to chop your head off. It's not interesting at all. But there are moments of writing about my work that are interesting, and they're sprinkled throughout. And part of what might happen once I get this code thing going is you'll be able to move through the different grids to the actual writing. And the writing will just be at the bottom. So it might show up. Depends on how things go. Yeah.
Any other questions for Annette? Of course.
Wait.
It just has to, for the podcast. It's good.
No, it just seems like your work grows out of the past towards the present, and it keeps growing into a longer and longer trip to the present. And I just wonder how the future figures into your work, if you only see the future as you pass it and look back on it.
Well, I have the next 6 months of my life planned out. I'm going to be making those drawings. But I don't know. I don't think much about the future. I do, in a way. I'm very pragmatic. You know, I'm a very practical person. So I think a lot about stability and things like that. But in terms of, having a sort of fictional future idea, I don't think I indulge, you know. Yeah.
I have a question for you. With the systems that you give yourself, like telling yourself that you know what you're doing for the next 6 months, I don't know about other people in the room, but that's just amazing to me that you do that and that you're so disciplined about it. Having done this for so long now, these systems being just kind of who you are, maybe, have there been moments of disruption in those systems that have produced something that surprised and wowed you? I mean, have you had moments of disruption within those systems that have created something unexpected?
I don't know. I think that there's been... I'll take a turn, I'll go with a turn, like I was making those square grids and I was like, this is not working, you know, and I'll shift it to something else. But once I find that dynamic thing that I'm looking for, I have not sort of, I've never abandoned a project, you know, like, well, I did, I abandoned one project. I was collecting junk mail for the next year after the pre-paper work.
Yes.
And I was going to make a gigantic spool out of it since I was making these paper spools. And that work, I started it, and then the paper just sat under my table for 2 years, and I eventually took it to the recycling center. I realized that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. I guess what I'm asking, is there ever a moment when life just insists on you leaving your system? You know, like... Have you ever not, other than the paper, the free papers, and you just became kind of, you lost interest in it, has there ever been anything that just wasn't going to allow you to finish it and it sent you in a different direction?
There hasn't been, no. I mean, maybe chairing my department. But otherwise, no. I mean, I've just been, I guess, very fortunate in that I haven't had any life things yet. You know, that that have derailed a project or anything like that. Just luck.
I think that's an amazing phenomenon in and of itself. Any other questions for... Yes, sir.
Nope, sorry.
Can I do this? I apologize.
So the holy grail of OCR is handwriting, and I wondered if you might consider going one step more granular for... word frequency and things like that through your past and how that might have changed.
Say that again.
So OCR is optical character recognition.
Right, yes.
Right, so the only way you can get that right now is through digital text, but as you think forward about maybe more granularly doing it, it might be worth your time to train an engine through someone's help maybe to recognize
read my handwriting.
Your T's and your S's and your C's and your letters. It'd take a lot of time, but it might be worth your while because you could then start doing things like word frequency throughout the history of your writing.
So right.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah, I'm interested in that. That's why I thought I would type it all, remember, back then.
Oh, right.
But this would work, like this technology. How good is it, though?
The Holy Grail is handwriting because it's not technically a font, but you'd have to go through yourself and train it.
To read my handwriting.
To be your handwriting. And it would, so it might be shorter than typing it yourself. It would be shorter than typing it yourself. But, so anyway.
That's a good idea. Well, thanks. So I have been encouraged to do that before. And it hasn't blossomed into anything yet. Yep. You said a technical term. Did you notice that went right over my head? I'm an analog person. Whoops. And I think of myself as an analog person living in a digital world. When I ask students sometimes, like, are you digital natives? So far, no one has said yes. You know, so far. I'm waiting. Yes.
The first piece you had with the dissolves between the two once upon a time slide projectors, now digital.
Mm-hmm.
The digital is kind of jittery and jaggy kind of thing, mm-hmm. instead of the smooth dissolves of analog. Mm-hmm. Are you happy with that? Or is it kind of like, well, this is what
this
I'm
is
stuck
really
at?
Where, yeah, I just resigned, you know, to it. There was another question in the center here.
Okay.
Yes, right here, right here. There, back there.
Thank you. As I was thinking about your presentation tonight, I was considering more digital and some other things. And so my question is, how do you perceive that the coding that you do permeates life and the spaces it occupies? I saw a juxtaposition in my head. And then I came and you presented something a little different. Uh-huh. And so I thought, wow. So
what was your question?
So how do you perceive that your coding, the coding that you do, mm-hmm. permeates life and the spaces it occupies?
Well, I haven't done any coding yet.
Yeah.
So it's you know, I think it's going to be What I envision is these circle grid drawings on a screen or projected somehow interacted with, you know, so people will be able to either touch something and open a new window and then find the same date and touch another thing and open another window, you know, and it just goes, it's just kind of like get further and further into possibly finding the writing at the end. This is just like so rudimentary because I really don't even know what coding is capable of doing. But that's how that's what I'm thinking of right now, you know, a really basic interaction that I hope to learn from, you know, to then build on, build other things.
Well, this looks like coding to me.
This looks like coding.
And there are lots of things that you can do with that,
yeah.
And things that you can draw from it.
So. Yeah. I think I'm right there. I'm just... Thanks.
Okay. I think that's... Call it an evening.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.